Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Today, I'm speaking to Adrian Papps, Professor of Politics at the University of Kent and Deputy Director of the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. I'm also joined by Alice Denby, Deputy Editor of CapEx, and Imogen Sinclair, Director of the Social Covenant Unit. Thank you for appearing.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. Lovely to be here.
Good to be here. Thank you
for having us. We're here to talk about levelling up and Michael Gove's white paper. Now, as we speak, tanks are currently rolling into the Ukraine, so we could be accused of the Swall Island mindset. But in a masterful act of chairmanship, I am going to tie it all together and argue that nothing could show more the importance of having an integrated and united country than what's currently going on in the Ukraine. So with that mentioned, so that we don't seem like we're completely forgetting world affairs, we're going to turn inwards. So Michael Gove, in his recent white paper, characterised the central problem of British politics at the moment as regional inequality. So our first question for today is, do we think that's correct? Adrian Paxton.
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt that Britain is one of the spatially most unequal countries among the 38 advanced economies of the OECD. That's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And it's really important to recognize, as the white paper does, that that inequality isn't just between regions, isn't just between the north and the south, or, you know, more specifically London and the southeast on the one hand and lots of other regions on the other hand. It's within regions. It's often running through communities. In fact, sometimes the same streets have got incredible disparities of wealth and decision-making power. So yes, absolutely, it is the challenge for the country, because if you have such unequal and uneven developments, you're relying on a single engine of growth to basically keep everyone going and, you know, somehow reduce it. But trickle-down economics hasn't worked, or hasn't worked well enough. And therefore, you can't just hope that London and South East will pull the rest along. That's not to say that London and South East should be dumbed down, or anything, you know, should be done to jeopardize their prosperity. But what it does mean is that unless you spread the source of economic growth and flourishing more widely, you are going to always have a situation where the rest of the country is effectively a drag on the successful parts. That's not good for the successful parts. It's certainly not good for the other parts. Therefore, yes, regional spatial inequalities are the big challenge.
Alice.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we do have regional inequality in this country, and it's the job of any government to make sure that its public services are providing more equally for all of its citizens. But I'm quite sceptical of this idea that what we need is a very paternalistic approach, an idea of sort of moving economic activity around the country. I think this whole analysis that underpins the levelling up white paper is based on a misinterpretation of the Brexit vote. I think this is a kind of Remainer idea that it was a consequence of people feeling left behind, and that what they really wanted was a big government to put its arms around them. I think that's a patronising idea. And I think that you can see that running through the white paper with all these ideas about sort of civic pride and turning coastal towns into Medici Florence. People would probably rather have a bus service that ran on time or a hospital with good doctors working in it.
So, I mean, I suppose the interesting question is, why haven't these areas got these things? And why have they lost them if they used to have them? And I wonder, I suppose the question I'd have here is, are issues of civic pride and identity the drivers of things like good public services, of an engaged populace? You know, so I think for that question, I want to turn to Imogen Sinclair, the Social Covenant Unit. What
are your thoughts on the new Social Covenant Unit?
The new Social Covenant Unit.
We're brand spanking new.
Was there an old Social Covenant Unit?
Yes.
And what did you do with it?
Failed. Replaced it. But I think that, you know, people talk about, this emphasis on high streets and pride and, you know, restoring local pride, as, you know, high-fluting, unimportant, airy-fairy, you know, apple pie stuff. But actually, I think it is really meaningful when people feel that they are proud of being from Barnsley, for instance. And I think a lot of what we try to do in the new Social Covenant Unit is try and talk about precisely that, that people kind of live and have their beings in their communities. So we talk a lot about kind of tiers of association, family, community, nation, and people live and have their being in community, in their places. And that's why polls suggest, evidence suggests, that actually people are remarkably less interested in income inequality than they are with actually the fact that I come from Barnsley means that life is just harder. And people feel that's rough and people feel that's unfair. And I also think, I'm conscious that Adrian won't want us to get onto the culture war, but in terms of organisations like Ben & Jerry's, for instance, forever making various political points, kind of pacifist points or whatever it might be, and actually they're not thinking about kind of their consumers, who their consumers are. Their consumers live these related and relational lives in the community. I remember when I was younger, from Sainsbury's and Tesco's, they used to give vouchers, and you could collect vouchers and you could give those vouchers to your school, and then the school could spend them on whatever it might be, football pitches or equipment or whatever. And, you know, when we think about inequalities, I think this regional inequality issue is really, really serious, because where people are from is incredibly meaningful. So I don't buy that the issue around restoring local places and civic pride is kind of nonsense and unimportant. I think it really, really is. It changes places and it makes places.
I think I there's two things I'd say to that. So absolutely, those things, civic pride, the sense of place, are incredibly important. But these are things that take generations to build up and to accrue. And they're also things that can be lost extremely quickly with poor public policy. And I'm just not convinced that the government can magic up those kind of agglomeration effects that you're talking about through some kind of way of picking winners. And the second thing I think I would say is that absolutely, I think goes into what you were saying, Adrian. I think it's the inequality within these places. It's the generational inequality. If you look at the 2019 election results, the kind of demographics within the red wall that were voting Conservative were actually the same sort of people who always voted Conservative. They were, you know, fairly old, home-earning, patriotic people. Life for them is probably not as hard as it is for young people in those regions. And those people should be able to move wherever they like in the country to pursue their ambitions.
So I think that all of that's really important, but there's a couple of things that are worth saying, I think. One is, I really don't think there is necessarily or inevitably a tension between economic and cultural arguments. In fact, much the opposite. I actually think that they're often just two sides of the same coin, because it's all about a sense of belonging and esteem and, you know, a role you play in society. And that is true for jobs, as it is for civic pride. But in fact, even jobs are not just sources of income, they're also sources of meaning and self-esteem. Yeah. So I think we mustn't fall into the kind of trap of binaries, where we say it's the economy or culture. Because I think that's partly what was so misleading in the whole Brexit debate, that, you know, somehow we said, oh, the culture values trump economic self-interest. I don't think it's quite like this. And for that reason also, I think it's correct to say that it's not all about central government. In fact, my worry about levelling up white paper, or rather the way it's going to be implemented or not implemented, is that it's far too much driven by Westminster and Whitehall. And I think it's right to say that central government isn't the answer to everything. In fact, we need many more intermediate institutions. That includes local government, but also businesses, trade unions, you know, reforming, renewing all of those institutions that are currently not working well enough. So I think it's right to say we shouldn't rely on sort of centralized paternalism. Though I think an element of paternalism isn't necessarily wrong. I mean, that's an argument we can perhaps come on to later. But I think it's absolutely right to say it's not economics or culture, and it's not just central government. There are many more layers that we need to think about. And I think that's partly the work that I think you're doing as well, because you're talking about tiers of association, and that's not central government.
Yeah.
Government can't create ties. So it's absolutely not the role of government. Yeah. It should create the space in which people can associate, but not tell people how to lead their lives.
Yeah, and these, sorry, can I jump in there?
No, go ahead.
These different capitals, be it social capital, economic capital, human capital, physical capital, whatever. As Adrian says, I think it really is important that we do see them kind of in the round and in the whole. I mean, there's the campaign called the Better Business Act that we've been talking to recently. And I don't know if you've come across this research around B Corps, these organisations that try and take their obligations to planet, it can be a bit something greenery, but planet, people, purpose. Remarkably, they do well. And I really doubted that. And then they sent me some evidence. And I thought, blimey, actually, if you're not solely focused on economic growth or shareholder value, whatever, you can do great things while making money and making people's lives better. And it's kind of like, I'm not sure I believe that until I saw it written down in black and white on paper.
So there's a worrying degree of, well, agreement on breaking out. So I'm going to try and throw a few cats to my pigeons here. One thing that Alice touched on is this question of mobility that's something I'm interested in. So, you know, So I think one possible criticism one can make of the frame of looking at geographic inequality is that people are not restricted by geography in the way in which they were even 50 years ago, let alone 100 or 200 years ago. People are basically free to go anywhere in this country and do so very quickly. I mean, half the country commutes to London now on a regular or semi-regular basis. You know, with a mobile population, does it make sense to think about economic growth in terms of lots of small regions? Isn't it, in a sense, make more sense to have, you know, specializations? You know, that it's okay for there to be a center where people come as young people and make their living.
Well, look, I think, sure, we don't want to have artificial barriers where people are told, well, if you're born in, you know, in Leeds or in you know, in Bradford or anywhere else, you know, that's where your life's going to be, and that's it. Of course, that would be, you know, it would be completely silly and you know, totalitarian. However, this idea of endless mobility in and of itself isn't a good thing either, because you want to be moving for a good reason. So lots of young people actually end up moving when they leave school and go to university. But what's interesting is actually 60%, you know, return to the region where they're from, you know, between basically the ages of, you know, 25 and 35. So that actually we don't have that single phenomenon of everyone moving to London or wanting to move to London. Actually, lots of people do not want to move to London necessarily. The problem isn't about the quantity of people who move to London or the Southeast. The problem is that often the best people think there's only really success to be had in London and the Southeast. They don't associate success with their
own. So you're saying there's a brain drain.
And it's the brain drain of the best that's the problem, not the kind of total, you know, number of people who may want to move to London and end up doing so. So I think that, you know, and that ties in with this meritocratic myth that there's one model of success. So unless you work in banking, finance or law, in the city, you are basically not that successful. Okay, or broaden that to a few other professions, say, you know, the professional managerial class. Okay, that presumably we're a part of, but leaving that to one side, you know, is that the only model of success, or can we think of vocational technical excellence, you know, innovation and so on, and spreading that a lot more geographically as well as across sectors, so that we don't rely only on the city of London. City of London is a great asset at its best. But to say that somehow if you're not in the city you haven't done well in life, obviously is a terrible message to promote.
But I think there are forces working the other way as well. So the incredibly high costs of housing in London, mm-hmm. and the Southeast deter a lot of people from either moving here or send people back in their 30s when they want to start a family, because that's they simply don't have the space. Right. And this Levelling Up paper was supposed to be accompanied by planning reform. Mm-hmm. That seems to have just been kicked into the weeds. And then there's talk about, you know, actually, perhaps what we need is to be building more houses in the north. That's a completely wrong approach. We need to have houses where there's demand.
Well, so again, I think you're absolutely right about, you know, where the demand is. But it's also the case that, you know, in some sense, supply can also be a factor, right? So where there is supply, people, you know, might be more tempted to move to. And I think some more house building wherever people want to live is the right thing. So what you don't want to do is you don't want to say to people who are from Grimsby, I'm sorry, there's absolutely no future for you in this town, right? And that would be a terrible message to send. Now, if someone wants to work in STEM sectors, well, then maybe Grimsby isn't going to be where they're going to end up. Fair enough. We're not suggesting that every town, you know, will cater to that. But just to sort of say, really, right off these places.
Silicon Cove is still a dream, Adrian. Still
well,
a dream.
Quite. But, you know, so my concern is that there are people who are simply prepared to write off large parts of the country geographically. And I think that's very dangerous because, yes, cities are incredible engines of, you know, not just innovation in a technical or economic sense, but also culturally. Of course, they're incredibly vibrant and so on. No one would ever doubt that or shouldn't. But, you know, there can be a place for towns and even villages in this. And especially with technology now and some more working from home, which is a permanent reality going forward. You know, why should we say to people, the only way that you can succeed in the job that you've chosen is by living in either London or Leeds or, you know, or Glasgow or Cardiff. That, you know, that's not a message I would want to send.
I don't think the Levelling Up white paper and Gove is saying that we all need to stay local, but I think he's definitely trying to avoid saying get on your bike as Norma Tebbit did. And it's always dangerous to quote politicians decades ago because it's inevitably out of context. But he did. He said get on your bike. And that's I mean, that does violence to places, I think, when you just say, you know, yeah, no jobs for you here in Grimsby on your bike. And I think for too long, government has been, governments have been sort of spatially blind, or indeed what they call social mobility has been geographical mobility. Let's get these guys out of the towns, out of the villages, into universities. And then, earning power is really important. And where does that happen? What happened to the Southeast? So I think the levelling up agenda is powerful, ambitious. But it is trying to redress that balance, which I think is really important. Going back to this issue of pride of place, I mean, it's just meaningful for people. I'm Cheshire lass, so I'm a really bad example of having come down to London and staying here.
Yeah, perhaps I should put my cards into it. I'm London born and bred.
We're like
the Londoner.
It's
right?
You indeed.
No doubt, a proud Londoner.
Very proud.
And rightly so.
Everyone should move here.
There we go. Well, that's not, I don't know if that would enhance London's pride.
Enough Londoners, I think, probably think that, frankly, is it good for everyone involved? Those who come from elsewhere and can't afford it, or don't feel as integrated or at home, as well as for Londoners who must feel that, there's just so much so much focus on it and such a pull on resource as well. So, I think it goes both ways. Surely some parts of London are probably now overpopulated, even if that sounds like a horrible term. But do you know what I mean? It's getting incredibly crowded, and that's not good for Londoners either. Those who are priced out, right? So, for instance, people who grew up in Dagenham and have now been essentially forced out, living way, way away from home, because then they can no longer afford it.
I think this, though, that we do need to now ask, though, is that, okay, so much for Grove's approach to regional inequality, but the question now comes, can it be done based on this white paper? So we've had this ambitious analysis that's been coming down, people have been talking about for decades. But is the government's plan to address it practical? Imogen.
I wrote this down because I thought it was quite cool. Here we go. Yeah, and Michael Gove and Andy Haldane.
This isn't good radio, Imogen. Yeah, it's all in your head. Let them know.
There are no papers here. Michael Gove and Andy Haldane in their introduction said, levelling up is a mission, part economic, part social, and part moral. And I think I was personally really struck by that sentence, because I think that government should be pursuing a substantive vision of the good life. And I think, maybe this is really lame, but I think in one sense, the levelling up agenda is an attempt at government to have a substantive vision of the good life. It's 333 pages. A lot of it is, there's some history, there's some plenty of economics and lots of graphs and things like that. But it's ambitious, it's long term. Adrian, in his article for you guys at The Critic, talked about successive governments being far too short termist. And here is an attempt at Michael Gove trying to really try and plan for the future. So yeah, it's big, it's ambitious. What's gonna make it happen, I think, though, is devolution, the genuine devolving of budgets, money, power to down and out, to local authorities, to communities out as well, I think is really the magic of the levelling up white paper.
I think we can all understand why the government is enthusiastic to talk about the future, but let's talk for a minute about the past. So there's, talk about, for example, local authorities, but there's often this sort of situation where Boris's government talks as if it's, year zero. But there is, a year minus five and a year minus 10. Mm-hmm. And those years involve, David Cameron and George Osborne and the austerity agenda. And in that period, it wasn't simply that the government decided to enact an austerity programme. And you can argue about whether that was necessary or how that was done. But what you can't argue with is that they had a choice between where to put the cuts. And overwhelmingly, they chose to ring fence central Whitehall departments, and they chose to shift the burden of cutting down to local authorities and to councils and to cities. And this meant, that libraries closed, local hospitals closed, that things became more centralised in every sense. And that now there's a sense to which is what's being offered even enough to make up for that, let alone, redress generational and regional inequalities.
Well, no. I mean, it's very clear that the envelope defined by the budget last autumn, and more importantly, the spending review doesn't, doesn't address, you know, those gaps nearly enough. Now, you know, we don't have to necessarily think that the only answer to that lack of funding is yet more central government spending through debt or tax, right? That would be one approach, but not one I would necessarily favor. I think one really good way to address some of these funding issues is to give certain revenue streams to local government or regional government so that they can spend it because they've got the knowledge, they have a better sense of local needs and interest, and there will also be better accountability, because I don't believe that the only model of accountability is for local regional government to be accountable to the Treasury. And I'm not saying that the Treasury doesn't matter. It's clearly incredibly important as part of the government machine, but I don't believe that the Treasury is or ever could be all-knowing and all-wise and can therefore decide on whether, you know, this town or that gets a little, you know, share of the pie. I think this competition between towns for very limited central funds is a terrible idea, because local towns will be wasting huge amounts of time and energy on getting the money, and if they don't get it, then what, right? And if they get it, it's really basically little more than confetti or peanuts, I'm afraid. So therefore, giving local government independent revenue streams would be a much better idea, whether it's business rate retention or even a share of income tax, you know, but something that they can then spend. I think that would be a lot better than just adding to central government debt or leaving us in the current situation where the funding is inadequate. I mean, just give you one example on skills. Okay, the government talks about a skills revolution, right, in the budget and the spending review. $3 billion over 3 years isn't a revolution, it's a drop in the ocean. Why? Because it takes us barely back to 2010 levels, and they weren't adequate. Okay, and I'm talking here about skills that are so crucial for productivity, prosperity, and for people acquiring, whether it's STEM graduates or technical and vocational skills, that's clearly vital. I mean, who can argue against skills, right? Who can argue against education? No one. The question is how we do it, where. Vincent, if you triple the funding of mixed ATFE colleges in places like Grimsby or Southend or Blackpool, you'd make a difference to the local skills base. You'd help businesses recruit people, you know, in those areas rather than locating elsewhere. Be a lot better. And $3 billion isn't going to do it on skills. And obviously, we can mention lots of other areas.
I think you make a really good case in the article that you wrote for The Critic about this need for kind of radical decentralisation and devolution. But I do think that that will lead to some political problems. I mean, if you look at the devolved administrations, how they've behaved, for example, during the pandemic, you know, always Scotland and Wales always just having slightly more restrictions. So you will get political problems with administrations like that trying to just show that they're different from the centralised government, which isn't necessarily good for the people. And I think there's another question of whether this is really what people want. So if you look at when there was a referendum for Northern Assembly, massive no vote campaign led by Dominic Cummings. And I don't think that the answer, if your analysis of the kind of the problems, the schisms in society, is that people didn't trust politics, then why is more politics the answer? But I think you make a really good point about these administrations would be far more accountable if they had their own revenue raising streams, and I think then you might attract, you know, better quality people, frankly, to work for them, and people more responsible.
I've got 2 points. One, Alice, one for Adrian. Plenty of disagreement here.
Ma'am, we like conflict.
So just that point about devolution, I think you're referring to what you quoted, Alice, in your Critic piece about the Northeast rejecting devolution. I think it's absolutely right. People don't want more governance in their life, like, obviously. But you know, devolution done well. I mean, there's a piece that may all come on to talk about in the white paper about community governance, kind of hyper-local devolution. But devolution done well, where genuinely we're giving budgets and power to local people, local communities, and we're therefore reducing the layers of governance above them, I think people do want that. They do want power. They do want control. So I take your point about people wanting less politics, but genuine devolution, you know, where there's kind of net gain of power because we're removing some of these layers and, you know, and devolving down to local communities, I think, is wanted. This is very unpopular.
There's more.
I think it's important to say that it's not all about the money. Obviously, there's a battle between, with COVID regulations as well, between Treasury and other departments, and that's always going to be the case. And it doesn't look like there's a huge amount of new money in the Levelling Up white paper. But Wigan Council, during austerity, established something called the Wigan Deal. And it was an attempt. It was the local authority said, OK, instead of salami slicing, losing our parks and our libraries and whatever else, We're going to do a deal with the local community. We're going to, I think it was freezing council tax. And what they asked of the community was basically neighbourliness. So we want you to look after your neighbours. If you're willing, we want you to take ownership of the community, ownership of your local swimming pool, try and run it yourself. I know people don't like it when volunteers run stuff for free, but, you know, when there's a will, there's a way. Anyway, Wigan Council, during that period of austerity, saved exactly what they needed to save, and it was remarkable, and it was done through a kind of a wonderful partnership between the state, the local authority, communities, local businesses, volunteers, and it worked. It worked well. So yes, of course we need money. Of course we need money, but we also need good leadership and power for the people. The New Social Covenant Unit published recently a pamphlet co-authored by 10 Conservative MPs called Trusting the People, and it's all about this sort of stuff, and it is powerful. And I'm not saying that I'm not saying because of austerity Wigan managed to achieve all these things. It's more a case of despite austerity, but there is a sense in which some of these pressures can focus the mind and can lead to innovative solutions.
Entirely, and I'm all in favour of them. And, you know, there's other interesting examples, you know, some arrangements in Preston where also they were more, you know, mutualised.
John McDonald's thing.
Well, and you know, where there's mutualism, and, you know, the only, I think, interesting economic idea that was really developed systematically by John McDonald was this mutual ownership, which I think is interesting, because it isn't the state, right? It's not Westminster Whitehall running things, nor is it. Is everything left to the private sector? And, you know, you need a good mix. You need some public ownership. You need lots of private ownership, but you also need more mutual arrangements. So, I'm happy where that can succeed. But I think there's a more fundamental issue. It's not just about the money, you're right. It is about Treasury command and control. That's the problem here. This is a Treasury-led thing, just like the Northern Powerhouse project was a Treasury-led thing. Treasury decided which deals were struck and which weren't. Let's remember central government falling out with Andy Burnham in Manchester, over 5 million. This is not how things should be run. This is really wrong. It's not just about the money, it's about who ultimately decides. And I don't agree that the Imperial Treasury should be running the country.
I feel like there's kind of fundamental contradiction in the thinking there, which I don't think kind of been lost on Michael Gove, and I feel like he's trying to, gloss over it in some way. But the contradiction is, you can't both kind of end a postcode lottery and have local people making decisions for themselves. If you're going to have the kind of devolution and the kind of sense of civic pride, then you're going to have inequality. It's going to happen. So I don't really understand how they're trying to sort of square that circle with this whole agenda.
I suppose an important question here is that inequality takes different forms. So that it's one thing to say there might be a place where both the cost of living is higher and incomes are higher. And then there are places where there's less, you know, they're not the high power drivers of growth, but they're comfortable places to live. But I think that one of the aspects of the old settlement of Britain, you know, before London became the be all and end all, was that as well as there being multiple economic centres, there was also an overall sense that the government guaranteed a basic safety net and a basic quality of service that made every part of the country livable. I mean, there was always potential for new areas of growth to emerge. And I think at the moment, when it's not that, you know, I think to this very good point about mobility, you know, the question of, you know, shouldn't we allow the economic growth to go where it wants? To agree, that's true. But we're not seeing, you know, one northern town eclipsing another. We're seeing one city eclipse everything else, one type of, you know, economic model, you know, the service financial economy dominate all the others. And at the moment, it's not that things are developing organically, it's that it feels like there's no scope whatsoever for any new economic centres to emerge. What would you say to that?
Well, look, on the whole, I think that's right. But the London thing, you know, has been around for 80 years. I mean, the Barlow Commission of 1940 was the first attempt by government to think about the north-south divide. OK, so that's how long this has been around. OK, this isn't something going back 20 or 30 years. It's not all about, you know, Thatcherism or New Labour. This has a long history, okay? And then if you went back 150 or 200 years, you'd see that actually, as part of the Industrial Revolution, lots of northern places were doing really well and the south wasn't. So, you know, pick your century, you're going to find some configuration, right, where something isn't working out. And, of course, Britain isn't.
Adrian Pabst of the Institute of Economic Affairs.
However, I think the fundamental point is you cannot and should not want to replicate the same model of success. You kind of look at mini Londons around the country, say, oh, well, you know, what works for London will ultimately work for, you know, Leeds and Newcastle and so on. And it's also the case for that very reason that the current devolution settlement is so problematic, because what we've really done is we've replicated London, right, or Westminster-type centralism in Cardiff and in Edinburgh. So that actually, if you go around Wales and Scotland, there are lots of people who don't feel that actually their government's particularly close to them or to their needs or to their interests. Mm. You know, the further you move away from Edinburgh and Cardiff, the less people are represented. So we don't want to have the same model of devolution just at slightly lower levels, because it doesn't work. It has to be either radically devolved, and I agree with you, Imogen, it is about decision-making. It is about giving people both powers but also responsibility, so that there is proper, sort of, you know, a proper accountability for what's being done. But you do need the resources, and what you really need is the institutions. The long-term institutions allow you to do this, because you don't want successive governments changing. You know, we've had endless policy and institutional churn, which has really been the problem. Nothing has been done longer term to address these problems. And that's partly why we're in this mess, because every government, whether the same party or of another one, you know, abolishes what the previous one has done. We had an industrial strategy council under Theresa May. It's abolished by another Conservative government. That's just one example, right?
Yeah.
That's not how you build institutions.
I think I do have some reason for optimism about new areas of growth. I mean, especially with the pace at which technology is evolving. So we have seen new kind of hubs emerge. So there's Silicon Fens in Cambridge. Mm. I recently learned about the Space Hub in Oxfordshire, which sounds terrific. It's like a centre of the space industry. Mm. And, you know, when with the drive to net zero, I'm sure we'll be seeing lots of new green tech, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to try and evolve in previously industrialized places. So I think that there is reason to think that we will find new areas of growth. But I think it'd be very difficult for the government to just kind of magic them up with a few million quid to Glasgow or whatever. Yeah. I think these technologies and these things emerge where there are pre-existing conditions for them to do so. I don't think the government creates those conditions.
I suppose my follow-up question would be, do you see a role for local democracy in creating those conditions or helping sustain them?
That's probably more a question for Adrian.
No, we've heard what he thinks about. I want to know what you think.
I have a problem with local democracy in the sense that, so in London, say, we have a Labour mayor who's basically in opposition to the Westminster government. And I think that tension isn't necessarily good for Londoners. And I think it is tempting in that situation for governments to sort of pork barrel to regions that are, you know, on their own team. So you see Andy Street and Ben Hatcher being constantly talked up as the best mayors there are. Lots of money being given to their areas and Londoners being left with kind of sometimes misplaced Labour policy. So that's the sort of problem.
So what you really want is a Conservative mayor for London?
Yeah, I just want Conservative devolution everywhere. I just think
it's certainly coherent.
I just think it's a tension, but I take your point that that local democracy might lend itself better to that kind of long-term planning.
So I'm interested in this point you raised about the possibility of conflict. So we've knocked centralisation quite hard. But is there also a deficit of central planning in this country?
Oh, certainly. And look, take the example of, institutions that I think do work elsewhere. I mean, Dominic Cummings, as we know, is a huge fan of, you know, what's called in America, you know, this sort of particular agency that can incubate, you know, scientific and technological progress and discovery and so on. And, you know, and I think that's an interesting example. Another example would be the equivalent of a national development or investment bank. Not to pick winners, not to say, oh, we're going to run the steel industry or the car industry or anything like this, not at all. But actually to underwrite private investment so you can unlock a lot more capital and you know, provide funding that isn't just, you know, conditional on, you know, whether there is a good capital market in that particular part of the country. Because people will be saying, oh, yes, of course, money's available everywhere. If you want to set up a business in, you know, in the Shetland Islands, someone will lend you money. The question is not that. The question is on what terms? Mm. Is it really competitive? And the answer to that is no, it isn't, because it's mostly on the terms that would be applicable in, you know, London and the southeast and the you know, the more successful, economically successful parts of the country. So you do need institutions that can link the national to the local or that are long term. And so a National Investment and Development Bank, I think, would be much better. Now, we have a National Infrastructure Bank in Leeds. It's great to put it there rather than in London. Although I admire Alison's, you know, pride of place and the fact that she's a very proud London, and that's wonderful. But it's good to have that institution elsewhere. But why limit it to infrastructure, and why endow with £14 billion? That's just not nearly enough. Broaden the remit, give it more capital so they can help unlock private investment. That would be a long-term thing. It wouldn't be run by government. It would be, you know, it would be in coordination with the best businesses around
it. And we've talked about the long-term issue. I mean, you raised a really good point with discussion of, you know, successive governments have all had their regional strategies, their industrial strategies. They put a token amount of money into them. They sort of die a quiet death, then the next government comes along. Is the answer for making levelling up sustainable? Should Gove be talking to Labour? Should this be a cross-party issue? Should that be the next step?
Lisa Nandy seems to quite like levelling up. I mean, she protests. I remember when on the 2nd of February in House of Commons when Michael Gove gave his statement and Lisa was saying, is this it? But I did, I've been doing some research on her recently, and she's forever saying stuff that's in the white paper. She set up the Centre for Towns. She's forever talking about, you know, she wants to stop this issue of getting out to get on. So does Michael Gove. So, I mean, Lisa, but you know, there is political consensus here, and I think she sees it. I think her leader is the problem.
I mean, are we in a political? I mean, this brings us well on to the politics. We discussed, you know, the policy and the analysis, but I think the question remains, you know, if you look at the current state of the Tory Party, you know, the divisions within it, you know, the ongoing problems with the leadership, and then you also look at, you know, what's likely to happen in that current election. I mean, do we have the political conditions to level up? Especially when I think just to raise one more quick issue, there's also the economic context, which is dire. You know, how is any government with those kind of challenges ever going to deliver something this ambitious or even begin it?
Well, so on the economic conditions, absolutely. You know, we're facing a decade of low growth. We're facing a decade, therefore, sort of low productivity. We're facing a decade where we'd like to move towards a high wage, you know, and high skill economy. It's a laudable, ambitious aim. But if you have low growth and low productivity and low investment, you're just not going to get there. And again, we don't want to rely just on ever more public debt to somehow plug the gap. So the economic conditions are dire. And that is one thing. I think politically we're not there yet, because there is not even a consensus within either the two parties, never mind across the board. Because in both parties, for different reasons, you've got the centralised and you've got the localisers, if I can coin that word, and I probably regret that for a long time.
Coin away, you know, you can just print money here. That's how we're power contributors.
And just as the Conservative Party has got its divisions at the moment around, you know, a more liberal libertarian outlook or more statist one, however we want to characterize that, the Labour Party's got a long history of being very top-down, centralized, you know, kind of diktat, you know, part of which is, you know, the problem with the NHS. It's a wonderful institution, but it's far too centralized. It doesn't, you know, nearly enough rely on local knowledge and so on. And then you've got others in the Labour Party who are very keen on devolution. But I don't think that the pro-devolution, the pro, you know, local democracy and local government part of the Labour Party is in the ascendancy. You know, when I look at the Labour Party, I see, you know, a lot of treasury orthodoxy, and I don't think that that's helpful. You know, where's the bold radical economic offer?
I think I can persuade Alice on this point that the political conditions for levelling up in the Conservative Party are perfect. So 2019 general election, you know, mass influx of red wall MPs. These are all naturally placey people. They're proud of being from Workington, they're proud of being from Barnsley, they're proud of being from Bishop Auckland, wherever it might be. And they're also properly conservative, so they are rightly wary of big state. And then you've got the freedom fighter, classical liberals, Steve Baker types, for whom the beginning and end of the good life is small state. You know, that's all they want, that's all they've ever wanted. And so big society came along and it tried to occupy this space, big society, small state, what's not to love about it? And I think big society is basically pretty perfect, apart from the one critique, which is important and notable, which is that there was this idea that we just roll back the state and big society will just pop up and flourish and all be happy and lovely again. So the critique, which is fair, is that there wasn't in the big society agenda the kind of building of capacity strengthening families, strengthening communities, strengthening the nation. That's new coming, you know. There wasn't a kind of capacity building agenda in big society, but I think that's what Levelling Up does. And I think Levelling Up can unite the kind of conservative red wallers, the Plessy people, the freedom fighters and the classical liberals, because what we're basically saying is we need to build capacity in our communities in order to reduce demand on the state and then shrink it. So I think political conditions are just perfect in the Conservative Party.
I mean, I have to say, I find that an incredibly, you know, optimistic outlook, which I admire, but you know, I generally don't see how you can reconcile, you know, a vision that does see a role for government. You know, the good government can do, as the May government put it, but, you know, the idea that central government is vital to this on the one hand, and a radical libertarian vision on the other hand. Because the problem with the libertarians is not just that they want a small state, which, you know, we can argue about. And it's not even so much the size of the state as the shape of the state. What exactly does the state fund and how does it run things and so on? So now let's get away from the argument of size to the argument of shape, because it's far more important. The other problem is that the libertarians don't believe in the very things that you talk about, community association, you know, place and so on, because for them it's radical individualism. They want individual choice. That's all they want. They want to maximize individual choice across the board. Now, they may or may not be right about this, but it's totally incompatible with community association, you know, ties of corporations on. You know, that's a more fundamental clash than I think, we're seeing.
I definitely think that the pitch he paints is a very alluring one, but I'm pretty confident that particularly the sort of conservatives that read CapEx are more the sort that Adrian describes. And the other thing that I think is a kind of political difficulty of this is that we've got an election in 2 years. We've got a bunch of MPs, red wall MPs in very marginal seats whose constituents are going to come to them and say, OK, well, you got Brexit done. Thanks for that. How have you levelled up? Mm. And they've got 2 years to do it. And the temptation for the government is going to be to give them a little bit of money for, you know, something in their town, a local business, something in their town. And then they can say, look what I've got for you. I've levelled you up. And that's exactly what will encourage this kind of pork barrel-y picking winners, not long term thinking. All the problems that we've identified with this agenda, and that's political difficulty of the current Conservative coalition.
But I actually think you raise a really good issue, because this is actually a real political trap for all attempts to decentralise, localise, you know, level up. That the retail politics of Britain is, we gave you £14 billion, we built that bridge, we built that railway, we built that road. Whereas if you genuinely give that power, develop that power downwards, you remove, you know, you lose the ground on which you're fighting in next election. So why would any political party ever level up?
Well, I mean, I think that's right. There's always that temptation to not just take back control, but then keep it. But the whole point about the Brexit debate was not to take back control from Brussels, only to then, you know, leave it in London, in a sense, Westminster and Whitehall, but actually to push it further down. That hasn't happened. Levelling Up has some very radical and ambitious ideas around local government and you know, mayoralties and so on, which again, in principle, I welcome, because I think it's important not to think of it as just run by number 10 and 11 in particular, or the rest of Whitehall. But, you know, I do think that fundamentally, you know, in philosophical terms, are we going to go down a more communitarian route, or is it going to be, you know, variants of individualism? And that's unresolved, I think, in all political parties. You know, you find the communitarians in the Conservative Party, in Labour and beyond, but can we say hand on heart that they've already won the political battle against the more individualistic outlook? I'm not sure. I fear that they haven't yet. I hope they will, but, you know, I don't quite see a majority, you know, or a kind of ascendancy of the communitarians to kind of, you know, craft that new consensus. Though I think intellectually it's there, and I think that is the agenda for the next 30, 40 years, but I'm afraid it's a tough battle to win.
Oh, ye of little faith. Well, can I just Alice's point about, yes, we have only got 2 years to the next general election, you know, what's Levelling Up going to look like in 2 years? How much can we actually do? In 2 years, James Daly, MP for Bury, has made, he'll be voted in again, like Spectre, touch wood, because he bought back Gig Lane, this historic football stadium for his community. I mean, that, and, you know, I was talking to James just yesterday, it's huge for the people of Bury that he was able to stop Gig Lane being bought and developed by private companies. Absolutely massive. And so, you know, he's done that in a matter of how long has he been an MP, a couple of years or so. And yes, he's had difficult conversations with Treasury, but he's done it. And, you know, that is truly meaningful. And that I mean, that is, frankly, just levelling up in action. You know, he's given this amazing community asset back to the community. And they're going to, you know, they're going to play a really important role in directing the future of Gig Lane.
I think, you know, as we get to the end of the podcast, one thing I really want to ask all of you is we've talked a lot about what's wrong with the current levelling up agenda and what the problems of this country are. But I'm interested in hearing what's the alternative, or what does levelling up done right look like? So, I mean, we've touched on a lot of, one big part of it, which I think is devolution. But is there, you know, but is there more to it? So, I mean, one thing I wanted to mention is that the best recent example of a levelling up agenda that we know in a comparable country is West and East Germany, where there was a massive fiscal transfer. You know, we're talking in the realm of a trillion rather than billions. The result, you know, and you can jot that up in, you know, miles of railway and road built, in high speed internet and infrastructure links, you know, in completely transformed urban centres, you know, so that if you look at, for example, where South Yorkshire was in 2008 compared to Saxony, you know, these were economically comparable regions. But over that time, South Yorkshire is only just now beginning to recover to where it was before the financial crash. That's 12 years on, whereas Saxony is now, you know, it's still behind other German regions, but it's well ahead of comparable regions in the north of England. So I'm interested, is that what good levelling up looks like? Does it look like putting your money where your mouth is and doing it for 20 years?
Well, so I think that that's a big part of it, but I think there's a couple of things to say. So the German way of doing it was incredibly expensive. And I think, you know, something which was done because there was a very broad national consensus that went well beyond party politics. You know, there was this desire to say, we have now integrated the Eastern, you know, the five Eastern Länder. We're now going to have to support them because otherwise they will all migrate to the West and that's not good for them or for us. So therefore, this was a national... Yeah, this was a national priority, and yeah, people genuinely supported it, you know, and there was a levy for many years, right? So quite exceptional circumstances, which you couldn't replicate anywhere else, really, unless you talk about, say, the reunification of North and South Korea, and that would be on an even greater scale, right? So I think quite exceptional, therefore, you know, probably not the best analogy. The other thing I would say is that the initial shock therapy in Eastern Germany was devastating. They actually decimated industry that could have been saved had it been properly restructured and protected for just a few years. So I don't think the German, you know, experiment there was universally successful at all. Having said that, the good elements of the German model are a more mixed, balanced economy. It doesn't rely on a single sector or on one or two sectors, though it is very export dependent. And, you know, that in itself is a problem when you look at international trade and China and so on, but it's less dependent on a single sector. It's got more institutions that support the economy and society, right? So professional associations, you know, even guild-type organisations, local government, regional government, and so on. So it's got a good institutional mix. And finally, and I think quite crucially, it has a much better way of saying there isn't one road to success. Yes, university matters for those who want to go, but you've got high-quality technical and vocational training. And that's something that needs to be built. It is in the white paper, but I don't think government policy is sufficiently developed now or indeed in the past. Because unless you build up the right colleges and you fund them and you give them the way to create courses and attract the best teachers and people and so on, you're not going to build the skills base that this country desperately needs. So institution building in general and at the level of vocational and technical training in particular, that's a big part of what it is to level up an economy.
Mm.
I think I'm not really an expert in the history of East and West Germany, but I'm pretty sure.
Don't feel the need to rumble Germany.
But I think where perhaps the analogy falls down is that the problems in East Germany's economy were a consequence of having been part of a planned economy, whereas what we have in Britain is more the consequence of industrial decline, which is kind of in some ways inevitable. So I think we're sort of starting from a different place. And yes, I think, as you said, Adrian, it was extremely expensive. I'm not sure we have quite the political will behind us to put all our money into that ambition. In fact, I think where there's consensus is that where there's money, it should go into the NHS.
So what should we do instead?
What we should do instead? I've written this down.
Oh, fantastic. By the way, this is terrible radio. She's taking this off the top of her head. Ignore the rest of it.
He's got this phone. That would be smart.
But I was actually responding to messages, which is, of course,
really?
The wrong thing to do.
Stop breaking the fourth wall.
Yes.
It's a radio, so there isn't one.
You're calling a friend and asking for help.
So I think
I would phone you if I was asking for help.
Oh, charming. I think, you know, if I could improve the Levelling Up white paper, what I would do is get rid of this parochial and depressing idea of staying local but go far. Young people shouldn't be discouraged from going wherever their ambitions will take them. We need to liberalise planning, particularly with a focus on those areas where there's the highest demand. And sorry, that is in the South and London. And where we want to spend money on infrastructure, we should do it where it can connect up existing economic hubs. We should be looking at the Oxford-Cambridge Isles. We should be looking at the Trans-Pennine Railway. We should be thinking about why Leeds is the biggest city in Europe but doesn't have a metro. Those are the things that I think could improve the Levelling Up white paper. That's what I'd be focusing on instead of some idea of turning places into Medici Florence.
Levelling Up white paper can only be improved by getting bigger and broader in scope, in my opinion. Levelling up two, exactly. But you know, there clearly have been difficult conversations, and there always will be, between Gove's department and the Treasury. But really, I think for Levelling Up to happen and to work well and to be what we all want it to be, is for, frankly, other departments to kind of step in line behind Gove's agenda. We're seeing a bit of this with kind of conversations around integrated healthcare, but the concern is that again is kind of this, it's kind of a centralised understanding of integration, and it's NHS being integrated with care up here rather than down there where people, as I say, live and have their being in communities. And so really I think what I'd like to see is levelling up. I mean, maybe it should be having its being in the Cabinet Office, you know, really shaping the entirety of government's agenda, such that DfE, DH, you know, schools and hospitals, that's part of social infrastructure. These are places where people live and have their being. That's part of the associational life. They ought to be, you know, singing from the same hymn sheet as Michael Gove, frankly. So, yeah, I mean, that for levelling up to be successful, it's got to be bigger and better and broader. And, you know, all these other government departments must defer to on every issue.
So we end our critic podcast singing hymns to Emperor Gove as he reigns over all of the parts of government and levels up all corners of the world and the former British Empire. So thank you very much for joining me, Alice Denby,
thank
Adrian
you.
Pabst, Roger Sinclair. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.